Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Before we get started here today, just a little bit of weather-related information I'd like to pass on to you. There are a number of school districts in our area that will be dismissing early today due to the heat. Our meteorologist Ed Keezer's forecasting a high of 93 today for Champaign-Urbana with an afternoon heat index of around 100 degrees. So if you're going to be doing things outside today, you keep that in mind. Tuscola schools will dismiss at 2 o'clock today and for the rest of the week. Villa Grove schools dismiss at 2. Arthur schools will dismiss at 1:30. Heritage School District will dismiss at 1:30. At St. Joseph and Ogden schools, the St. Joe Middle School will be letting out at 11, the grade school at 11:10, St. Joe Ogden High School dismisses at 11:20, and Prairie View Ogden Grade School will let out at 11:30. And if we do have information on other heat-related early closings, we'll certainly pass that on to you as soon as we get that information. Well, this morning, in this part of Focus 580, this first hour of the show, we will be talking about the American dream. And I'm sure that as soon as you hear that phrase, you know what that means. Americans have long believed that hard work, perseverance, perhaps with a little bit of luck, would lead to prosperity, not only for themselves, but for their children and their children's children. At the same time, it seems that many have begun to question this notion that hard work leads to prosperity, particularly the idea that each new generation will have a higher standard of living than those people who came before. In this part of the program, we'll explore this idea of the American dream and how long it has been a part of American thinking and perhaps how it's changed over time. And our guest is Calvin Gilson. He's professor of political science at Southern Methodist University. He's also taught at Louisiana State and at the University of Colorado. He went to SMU in July of 1995 as professor and chair in the Department of Political Science. He was the director of the John Goodwin Tower Center for Political Studies and chaired the department from 96 until 2001. He's the author of a book that explores this subject area that we'll be talking about here this morning. His book is The American Dream, The Politics of Opportunity and Exclusion in American History. That book is published by the University of Kansas Press and came out in 2004. So I'm sure if you're interested in reading it, you can seek it out. Questions here on the program, of course, are welcome. We always like to involve people who are listening in the conversation. If you had questions, comments, that's great. The only thing we ask is people are brief so that we keep moving and get in as many as possible. But of course, questions are welcome. The number, if you are here in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions, you want to join the conversation, you are welcome to do that. Professor Gilson, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
It's good to be with you.
The term is relatively recent. That is the American dream. The phrase is relatively recent. I think that dates maybe to the 30s, 1930s, something like that.
That's correct.
But the idea, it goes back much further, really to the beginnings of America. And I want to talk a little bit about that. But having said those two things, then it seems to me that for a lot of people today, their point of reference for what the American dream means is the post-war period. It's this period of really exceptional prosperity that goes from about 1945, so it was at the end of the war, up until the early 1970s, when economically things really changed and people started thinking about their prosperity in sort of negative terms. So maybe we could just talk a little bit about that point there. What you do in the book is you look at various points in American history from the beginnings, the Revolutionary era, all the way up through the present. Let's talk a little bit about that time, the 50s and 60s, and how people at that time thought about this idea of the American dream and what it meant.
Well, the American dream, as you suggest, is a very old organizing idea in American history, and it is that each generation will have the opportunity to succeed and to thrive and probably to do better than the previous generation. And as you suggest, the the post-World War II period is most alive in American thinking, because you came out of the 1920s, called the Roaring Twenties, into a terrible period of the Great Depression, the 1930s, World War II, and then the emergence of the modern world dominating global American economy of the 1950s and 60s, where Americans down through the middle class and working class, even into the working poor, did very, very well. And the idea that they were secure, they were prosperous, they could take care of their families and their children, would do even better, became fixed. But the period from the mid-1970s to our own day has really challenged the idea that each generation will do better than the previous one.
When you look back in American history and you look back at, let's say, particularly the years, say, before the Civil War, or at least before 1900, and you look at how people thought about what success meant and what were the markers of prosperity and what it was that they were hoping for, it seems to me that now, as we think about the American dream, it's defined almost exclusively in terms of material goods, the standard, the sort of material standard of living that we have, how much stuff we have. Was it always the case that Americans thought in that way? If you ask, you know, you ask them about this and ask them to talk about how they were doing and what their aspirations were and whether they thought they would achieve those, was the emphasis always so much on a material measure of well-being?
Well, that was always a big part of it, but it was also always the case that people warned against an undue materialism in American life all the way back through the founding period and the 19th century. There was always a sense that Americans were driven, that they aspired not just to security, but really to strike it rich, to make it big. And so there were always people religious lives, philosophers, social commentators, Emerson, for example, in the 19th century, who warned about the need for a balance in American life between what was sometimes referred to as the outer world of business and seeking prosperity, and the inner world of the heart and the soul, and to try to create some balance between your inner life and your outer aspirational search for prosperity. But that call for balance usually went unheeded. You think about things like the gold rush of the late 1840s and 1850s. Think about the Oklahoma land rush of the 1880s. And you think about the Wall Street climate of today, and you see that wealth is the easiest measure of the American dream, but never the only measure. Mm.
Was it always the case that as we have discussed, there is this idea that over time, it's almost not enough to do as well as your parents did. But there also is this idea that children should expect to do better than their parents did. I suppose to have a bigger house, to have a bigger car, to have more cars, to make more money, and then that's this kind of ever rising tide that each generation is this. There's this idea that each generation is supposed to do better. Was that something that always was an idea that was again sort of embedded in this idea of the American dream?
From the very beginning. Mm. And it was really a fairly approachable goal. It was frequently realized in the first couple of centuries of American history, because we had a continent that, from the perspective of white settlers, lay open before them. So the idea, Horace Greeley's phrase, "Go West, young man," Abraham Lincoln's land policy that says we'll give you 160 acres. If you hold it for 3 years and improve the land, it's yours in fee simple. It's yours outright. So there was always an opportunity for the rising generation, American young people, but also for immigrants to come to this country and have a legitimate prospect of establishing themselves, creating stability and a certain amount of predictability and prosperity for their families, with the possibility of doing even better than that. And over the course of most of American history, although there were always ups and downs, always boom periods followed by periods of bust, recession and depression, American generations have generally done better than the previous generation. And the period 1973, excuse me, the period 1973 through the most recent reports of income figures for 2005, which were on the front page of the New York Times just yesterday, is a period when a generation has essentially stood still in terms of median family income, and that's quite distinctive in American history.
Yeah, well, that's it does get at something that I was thinking about, and maybe you might talk a little bit more about, and that is this idea that I'm certainly there were times before when there had to have been great pessimism and great doubts about the future and whether, in fact, this dream of rising prosperity for ourselves and for our children would have been questioned. Certainly, I'm sure at the time of the Depression, it would have been questioned. There must have been other times in American life, too, in American history, too, when people, perhaps as they are today, really wondered about the future and wondered whether they were seeing essentially the end of the dream.
Well, that's right. In fact, it's a very pronounced rhythm in American public life that there will be periods in American history, like the Jacksonian era, the post Civil War era, the 1950s and 60s, where the American dream does seem to be widely available, and there is a sense that anyone who learns well, works hard, is careful, saves, can be in a position to take care of their families. But there are also other periods in American history where the dream seems to fade and to become much more difficult for a wide range of Americans to attain. And the Gilded Age of the late 1880s, 1890s is one of those periods. The Roaring Twenties, late, and 1930s is one, and really the post-1975 period and our own time feels to many Americans, working-class Americans, even middle-class Americans, that things are tightening down, and it's getting harder to provide for your family and harder to be secure that your children are going to have a chance to do better than you did. And that sense that the American dream is receding has usually brought a political upheaval that leads to policy changes in things like tax codes, things like access to land in the 19th century, education in the 20th century, healthcare in our own time, because Americans see their country as having made the promise of an opportunity if you work hard to succeed. When that opportunity seems not to be there, they generally look for people who will work to increase access to it and to bring it back to a fuller realization. And we may be moving into a period like that today.
Just very quickly, let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Calvin Gilson. He is professor of political science at Southern Methodist University and has authored a number of books about American history and politics, including The American Dream, The Politics of Opportunity and Exclusion in American History, a book that looks at how it is over time people have thought about this thing that we call the American dream. The book was published by the University of Kansas Press in 2004. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think there you're getting at what is another interesting subject to examine, and that is I think that we also, in addition to believing this idea that hard work can lead to prosperity, I think we also have this idea that it's something that people have done or can do by themselves, and that we tend to underappreciate the fact that over time, government has instituted various deliberate kinds of policies that were intended to foster the development of wealth and growth, and so that there were indeed government, in spite of the fact that a lot of people think that government doesn't do anything right, that there have been a number of things that government has done that indeed have promoted the kinds of things that we're talking about. Can you talk a little bit about perhaps, again, and look back a little bit and talk about how over time, deliberate government policy has been put into place that was intended to and, in fact, indeed did result in this kind of opportunity?
Yeah. I might mention there's a change in the title of the book. Its title is Pursuing the American Dream. And so if people are looking for it, look for it under the title Pursuing the American Dream. But one of the key themes of the book is that the American Dream is not a naturally occurring phenomenon. It's a socially constructed phenomenon, and it really requires both personal responsibility and social responsibility to match up. The personal responsibility part, as you suggest, is often the one that people think of first, and that is the idea that if you learn or train well, gain a skill, work hard, save your money, that there's a very good chance that you'll be secure in America, that this country provides average people, working class and middle class people, a better chance to succeed and thrive than virtually any other country in the world. But for that to be true, society has to provide a context, and that context has a policy dimension that has changed over the course of American political history. In the 19th century, the key thing that government had to do to provide the opportunity to average Americans to succeed is make sure that they had access to land at low or no cost, so that you could say to people, we will give you free land, but you have to have the grit. You have to have the determination to get there, maybe to Illinois in the 1830s and 1840s. And then you've got to clear that land and you've got to make it bloom. But we will provide the opportunity for that land. You've got to provide the work to make it bloom. In the 20th century, the best equivalent of cheap or free land is cheap or free public education. Excellent public schools that make sure every child has the opportunity to develop their talents, and then for those whom it makes sense to go on to college. When I went to college between 1967 and 1971, it wasn't called Pell Grants then, but you could get government-supported grants that were the equivalent of tuition for the year. And then you were assumed to work in the summers to pay for books and rent and those kinds of things. But the government had very actively made sure that anyone willing to work would have the support that would allow them to go to a major state university like the University of Illinois. Mm-hmm. That's no longer the case. Now Pell Grants pay for about half of tuition at most state universities, and lots of families really struggle with the idea of how are we going to get Jack and Jill through college. Community colleges are available and they're cheaper, but if the foundation of aspiration in 21st century America is going to be a high-quality education, then public schools and access to college have to be easily available, and they're not easily available today. So the policy fix to that would be more money, full funding for No Child Left Behind, and an increase in Pell Grants and other kinds of support for college, so that everyone who had the ability and the drive had the opportunity to go to college and then move off into the workforce well-equipped to strive and succeed.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think there are some conservatives who have been arguing for some time now that perhaps the way to encourage people to build wealth, something that in a way paralleled the Jeffersonian idea that the basis of wealth was land and you needed to make it possible for people to own and develop land, that classic sort of yeoman vision of America. There are some people who say that the way to do that today is to promote people's investing in equities, essentially in stocks, and that's the way that people can – it's really not an option to do it in the old way, in the Jeffersonian way. Someone say, well, this is actually kind of the achieving the Jeffersonian goals by Hamiltonian means. And someone has coined that phrase. It was not me. And it's something particularly I think now conservatives are really interested in trying to promote. Have there been times before particularly, I guess this would have been during the 20th century, when there was that deliberate sort of strategy to get people to build wealth? If land wasn't going to be the base anymore, then it would have to be something else. That was the thing that people thought about?
Oh, there's no question about it. And in the 20th century, investing in equities was one of the pillars of George W. Bush's attempt to reorganize the Social Security system in 2005 and 2006. Even more recently, the idea of expanding home ownership, because equity in one's home is the largest store of wealth for two-thirds of American families. So conservatives have generally made the argument that investing in equities and even more importantly in home ownership is the best way to build wealth for a secure future and particularly a secure retirement. And if you look at the debates even over the last two or three days over what to do about the difficulties in the subprime mortgage market, where somewhere between 1 million and 3 million people face the prospect of losing their homes because their adjustable rate mortgages are going to drift up substantially in the coming months and years, mm-hmm. is handled differently by Republicans and conservatives who argue that the market needs to work out some of the excesses of the home ownership market of the last couple of years, where Chris Dodd, a Democratic senator from Connecticut who's running for president but also is chairman of the Banking Committee in the Senate, was meeting with Chairman Bernanke of the Fed and the Secretary of the Treasury, arguing that government should step in and provide support to individuals who are struggling to meet their mortgages so that they can keep contact with the American dream, can keep their home. So there have always been two views of how the American economy should be organized so that it provides most opportunity to most Americans. The conservative or Hamiltonian view is to try to create a dynamic economy and then leave people to compete for their position within that economy. Winners should be able to enjoy the benefit of their hard work, their entrepreneurship, and their luck, whereas the losers in that struggle should be encouraged by the difficulties of being a loser to get up, dust themselves off, and re-enter the competition, whereas liberals, Jeffersonians, Jacksonians, Roosevelt in the 1930s, and the Democratic Party of today have always said that there are substantial numbers of Americans who simply are not in a position to compete effectively today, and so we need to work harder to provide education, health care, job support. If you lose your job to outsourcing, you need to have support to retrain and retool. And the policy aspirations of the Democrats always require larger taxes to fund those programs. So there is a fundamental dispute that runs through American history, from Alexander Hamilton fighting with Thomas Jefferson in the Washington administration up to George W. Bush arguing against Hillary Clinton about how best to deal with an economy in which lots of people are struggling.
Yeah. Well, I think that's certainly an important point, and I guess one shouldn't ignore the fact that, yes, at least when it comes to home ownership, that government has done what it could to encourage people to own real property, either by creating funding mechanisms or, I suppose, the big thing certainly that has been a benefit to the middle class is the opportunity to deduct the mortgage that they pay on their home loans. And now, you know, maybe as things have changed over time, that we have fewer people itemizing, so they don't take advantage of that. But I think that has probably for a long time been a very significant benefit to an awful lot of people who are in the middle class.
Yes, yeah, that's right. About half of Americans have a significant exposure to the equity markets, to stocks. Most of them through 401ks and mutual funds, but about three-quarters of Americans own their own home. And George W. Bush worked hard to try to expand the number of people who could own their own homes up through the 70s. It's about the mid-70s now because, again, two-thirds of Americans have the bulk of their savings and their equity of the support for their retirement in their home equity rather than in the stock markets. And so how you expand home ownership without encouraging people who don't have the income flow, at least the predictable income flow to support those mortgages to own homes has been fairly tricky, and we may well have overreached and encouraged people who didn't have the economic wherewithal to buy a home to get into homes. They're now being foreclosed upon, and the question is, do you do something active through government to buoy those people up through this period, or do you let the markets cleanse themselves and let those foreclosures take place? And generally, Republicans say, let the markets work, and Democrats say, reach out and sustain the people who are in the most difficulty and see if you can't carry them through this difficult time.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here. Let me just introduce again our guest, Calvin Gilson. He's professor of political science at Southern Methodist University and is author of this book. And my apologies about getting the title wrong there. I have one piece of paper here. It has one title, and then I actually have the book in my hand, so I should have been able to get it right. The title, if people are interested in taking a look at the book, is Pursuing the American Dream, Opportunity and Exclusion Over Four Centuries. It's published by University Press of Kansas and came out in 2004 and takes a look at this notion of the American dream. The term is relatively recent, but the idea is not. It goes all the way back to the beginnings of the country. And what he does in the book is take a look at how people thought about the American dream, how things changed perhaps from major period to period in the country, going back before the Revolution and then through the period of the Civil War and the time after and all the way up to the present. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think one of the things that we've talked about is the fact that now there are a lot of people who feel that the American dream is something that's just out of reach. And that, in fact, we may have growing numbers of people who feel that it's something that's out of reach. But I think it's an important point to make, and certainly you do in the book, is that all along there were people who were excluded from the American dream, and that perhaps you might make the argument that, yeah, things are not what we would like them to be now. There are people who feel that it's something that they can't achieve. But is it fair to say that you think that it is more open now, it is more possible now than it has been at most other times in American history?
Well, I think in a sense that's clearly true, because if you go back before the Civil War, obviously the American dream was on offer only to white men and not to women, not to blacks and other minorities. And as you move through American history, it has been grudgingly opened to new classes of people, to black men briefly after the Civil War and then closed out again by Jim Crow segregation until well into the middle of the 20th century. Women participated in the American Dream from the beginning along with their husbands, but not independently. So it's well into the 20th century before women receive the vote, say, in 1920. And it's a post-World War II phenomenon that that women in the workforce is common. Today, 75% of women with children under 18 work outside the home, and two-thirds of women in general work outside the home. They tend to make something like 75-76% of what a man makes, and if you look over a 15-year period, it's substantially less than that because women tend to be in and out of the workforce more than men. So the American Dream is on offer to all Americans, including women, including blacks, Hispanics, and other minorities. But there are still differences in achievement levels, and different people look at that and say either that is natural because women have a role in nurturing and family building that leads them to take more of the initiative in home life and child care, so they're in and out of the economy in a natural way, whereas others would say that is still a function of social norms and expectations of a bygone era that we should work very hard to continue to clear away by providing support to single women in particular with children, but all women to make sure that adequate child care, health care for children, support to women who leave the workforce temporarily to have a child to make sure that they can move back into the workforce without losing momentum, that they're not going to lose jobs, that they'll have the opportunity to mold their schedules to ensure that they can take care of children who are ill or those sorts of things. So different people look at differences in performance, comparing white men to minorities and to women, and say those differences mean we still have a lot of work to do. Others say the American economy is now open to those who are willing to work hard and struggle to achieve.
Well, we have several callers here. We'd like to bring them in and get their thoughts. We'll start with someone on a cell phone. This would be line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Yes, I enjoyed listening to this particular segment. I have to be driving west here. And anyhow, interesting discussion. A couple of comments from earlier on related to the comparison of the different we'll call it post-war episodes, but frankly, the difference between World War II and the post-Vietnam. I'm a Vietnam vet. I got some degree, the degree between 62 and 69, and then got drafted, went in, and came back and did a master's. But there was one major difference that I would point out to the professor. Any person that graduated either with a two-year associate or a bachelor degree, I would say any time between 60 and certainly 69, it was a guaranteed job no matter what the degree was. You were simply acknowledged as having gone through a degree process at any university, college, or junior college, and therefore that gave you, it admitted you to the job market, no matter what the discipline was. And the other thing was the tuition in those days, early days, early 60s, was literally 5 to 10 times lower per semester than what it is today. Yes, I could go out without very minimal, I didn't even need an assistance in the 60s. I worked and got a degree at night. I finished up a bachelor's that way. So I would not consider today's world, the students have great difficulty getting in. A bachelor's degree, even in some of the science disciplines, means nothing. Really, it means you're about almost one level above a high school graduate, if that. Jobs are very difficult. You almost have to have a master's. I believe you have to have master's or working towards a master's even to teach today. So I just cannot compare. And also what I'm really concerned about is we have created a permanent poor class in today's society. Because I came from extremely poor people in northeast Pennsylvania coal regions, I had no problem working, getting into school, finishing degree, getting drafted, so forth and so on. Today, it's all different. The other thing is that I believe the companies that we worked for in the 60s, not so much in the 70s, were ethical. And today, I view them as most of the CEOs some of the large corporations, all they're interested in profit, moving out of the country. I just heard yesterday that even Hershey's chocolate is contemplating or decided to move to Mexico. So it's just a bad combination for our young people. I sort of dismissed immigration. I think good, hardworking people have as much chance as they did as their ancestors, because everybody was a migrant, even back when our grandparents came in the turn of the century or before. They had it worse than we did.
Well, let's get some.
That's the issue. I cannot compare age or post Vietnam to post World War II. And I'm post World War II. The chances were there for anybody who wanted them. Not today.
Yeah, this is a great call. It makes exactly the point that that we obviously didn't make clear enough, which is that the post-World War II period, the generation that the caller and I grew up in, as I mentioned, I went to undergraduate school, the bachelor's degree between 1967 and 71, and then I was drafted as well and came out of the Army and went to graduate school on the GI Bill. So I got an MA and PhD on the government's dime, which was a wonderful thing. But as the caller suggests, that post-World War II generation that he and I were in the late stages of the World War II generation, early stages of the baby boom, benefited from the fact that that social policy, government policy, made it easy for people to go to college. State legislatures supported their state universities, like the University of Illinois, with enough state allocation of funds that the tuition that the caller and I were called upon to pay was so low that we could pay it easily with a summer job and maybe a little bit of work in the evenings as well. So, but anyone who wanted to go to college could do it, not because they were so dramatically more hardworking than students are today, but because the barriers to entry, the hurdles they had to get over, were so much lower. And lots of other government policies supported people in buying homes and getting their families started. Whereas today, taxes have been reduced, which is a benefit to lots of people, but when taxes are reduced to a point that the revenues going into government no longer allow governments to support state universities or adequate health care or other kinds of supports to individuals and families, it gets a lot tougher. And so students looking at going to college, as the caller suggests, find the barriers to entry, the costs, the hurdles they've got to get over just much higher. And the point that I tried to make in the book is that is a function of government policy. It facilitated admissions when the caller and I were getting ready to go to college. It does not do that nearly as well today, so the expense of going to college falls on students and their parents, and they find it crushing.
I want to thank the caller. We have several others. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I'd also like to introduce again our guest, Calvin Gilson. He is professor of political science at Southern Methodist University, and he is the author of a book that explores this subject we're talking about here this morning, that is the American dream, what it means, and how that meaning perhaps has changed over time, how the ability of people to actually secure it has changed over time. His book is Pursuing the American Dream, Opportunity and Exclusion Over Four Centuries, published by the University Press of Kansas. We have some other callers here. Next, let's go to line number two for someone else. This is Champagne. Hello.
Hi, David.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call. Sure. Yeah, I guess my question is going to try to prompt the professor to go in a slightly different direction. I mean, I take it from the subtitle of the book, The Social Construction of Opportunity, or something to that effect, that that there's a big emphasis on not just, econometric studies of, you know, how the economy's expanded over time to embrace lots of other people, but also has this component of exclusion. And I guess I was wanting to hear a little bit more about how the principles of exclusion have operated to, in effect, construct this whole notion of the American dream. I mean, it seems to me that you take the long view of American history, the American dream is, you know, essentially white in color and male in gender. I mean, I think it was Ida B. Wells who said right after, you know, in the first couple of years of the Depression, that black folk kind of chuckled when white people started complaining about the Depression because, in fact, their whole lives had been one economic depression. And sort of taking that further up into the, the great period of expansion to which the author just alluded, the 50s and 60s, I mean, even really up until, not really till the late 60s, there were still large segments of America, in particular black rural America in the South, but not just limited to blacks, rural America generally, that were, you know, kind of left behind, or at least treading water at best. So it seems to me that an alternative way of looking at it could, you know, might suggest that the social construction of opportunity or the social construction of the American dream has at its very core, at least up until very recently perhaps, these elements of exclusion that have obscured as much as they've revealed about the American experience. So I guess I just I'd like to hear his thoughts on that some more, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right, well, thank you. Well, yeah, go ahead.
Another really good question. In fact, the title of the book is Pursuing the American Dream, and the subtitle is Opportunity and Exclusion Over Four Centuries, and that exclusion is a major theme. In fact, the concluding section of every chapter in the book, and the chapters are the major periods in American history from the colonial period forward to the modern era, is entitled The Faces of Exclusion. And that section of each chapter talks about the religious, the sociological, the economic and the political legal devices that were used to determine who was eligible to pursue the American dream and who was ineligible, who was outside the social construction of citizenship and full participant in the American society and its economy. And at early stages of American history, far more people were excluded from full citizenship and participation in the polity and the economy of the United States than were included. As you suggest, and as we talked about a bit earlier, white men were the citizens, the participants in the American society and the economy early on, and the exclusion included women and all people of color, and the opportunity to be included came slowly, haltingly, and grudgingly. It was the post-Civil War period when slavery was ended and there was a brief attempt to provide equality to black men, lasted only 5 or 6 years, the period of Reconstruction, and then Jim Crow set in for another century. And women slowly emerged in the post-World War II era, voting by 1920, full entry into the workforce only in the post-World War II period, and as we talked about a bit earlier, still not full equality and inclusion because earning levels for minorities and women still lag men. So the question open today is, are those differences in achievement in some sense natural between men and women, or does it mean that there's still a long way to go to provide full equality to all adult Americans who want to pursue opportunity within this society and economy?
Well, again, I want to thank the caller. We have a couple of minutes left. We have another caller I want to make sure we get in. This is Champaign County and line 3. Hello.
Hi. As it's the anniversary of the execution of Sacco Vanzetti, I wanted to ask about that period because it seems to me that we sort of have some resonance here with the anti-immigrant status, the race to the bottom about jobs, and I'm wondering how you cover that period. I've been listening to some documents about that just now, and it strikes me that the alienation of that immigrant workforce, at the disillusionment with the American dream that was experienced at that time, is what led to this kind of ferment that produced the scapegoating. And that's my opinion, but. So I'm wondering whether what you have to say to that, and also I think bleeding over into the next hour, the idea that we can have a Supreme Court justice that says that this idiot tautology that the way to stop discriminating on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race, that actually resonates more with what you were just talking about. I'll listen. Thanks.
Yeah, Immigration has been a flashpoint in American political history going all the way back. You think of the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1898-99, which was the first time, after American independence that there was a reaction against the presence of immigrants within the American society. You think about the Asian Exclusion Acts of the 1880s and 90s. Sacco and Vanzetti is the teens and 20s, which was the end of a period of very large immigration waves that started in the 1890s and ran through the 1920s until in 1924 immigration was essentially shut down almost completely because established American elites and groups that had been here for quite some time felt increasingly overwhelmed, so they shut down immigration for nearly 50 years, not until the mid-1960s when it was opened up again. And you're right that our period feels like the 19-teens and 20s because we're again in a very large immigration wave, and every time we are, established groups feel that the new groups are not integrating fast enough, that they're exclusionary, trying to maintain their own culture, not learning English. And so my sense is that a society has to be able to control its own borders, but it doesn't have to control them for the purpose of shutting them. It would control them for the purpose of knowing who's here and what kinds of qualities and abilities they bring to the society and economy. So immigration is something that the country has been concerned about throughout its history. And it seemed to me there was a second element of the question, David, if
you
remembered it.
Let me just, instead, if I might, because we're almost out of time, I want to pose another quick question, and I can only give you about a minute. But I'm interested because you said earlier that if you look back in American history at the times when we seemed to be at a low point, when people really doubted the ability of the American dream, there was often a dramatic kind of response from government. If we are now in one of those parts, and we now happen to be entering into a presidential election cycle, we're going to have another administration, would you expect that perhaps the new president or the Congress would do something, and I don't know if you have anything in mind specific that might happen in a way as a response to current feelings about the fact that for a lot of people, the American dream is out of reach, and maybe that there's something government can do to bring it a little closer?
I do. In fact, the last chapter of the book is, as you know, is a set of policy prescriptions for rejuvenating the American dream. And my sense is that the last 20 years, 25 years, have been a Republican era in which individualism and self-help have been a major theme. Tax cuts in the Reagan era, and particularly in the Bush era, have been substantial. The estate tax, the Republicans call the death tax, is scheduled to go out of force. And I think that the electoral response in 2006, which returned Democratic majorities in Congress, and the advantage the Democrats have heading into the 2008 election, presage a Democratic administration in 2008 that will move to take away some of the Bush tax cuts at the upper levels, restore the estate tax, and try to use those revenues to increase spending on education, on health care, on job training, to try to establish people's confidence that striving still makes sense and the American dream is alive. So I think that there is a reaction underway, and we'll see whether or not that turns out to be true.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much, Professor Gilson, for talking with us today.
Thank you, David. I enjoyed it.
Our guest, Calvin Gilson, he's professor of political science at Southern Methodist University. His book, if you'd like to read it, is Pursuing the American Dream, Opportunity and Exclusion Over Four Centuries, published in 2004 by the University Press of Kansas.